to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. I'm furious, and I'm fed up. What the Democrats are doing to trash this country, and specifically to trash our Constitution, is unconscionable. And the incessant, unrelenting assault against the president is absolutely unforgivable. That's one of the things I want to talk to you about today. So let's get started. You're listening to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is the Friedman Report. So let's take a look at what's been going on. You know, before the president was even elected, the assault was on. He was being spied on by the deep state, his campaign, the people on his campaign. In fact, the Democrats used a made-up dossier that we now call the Steele dossier, because it was written by an ex-British spy by the name of Christopher Steele. And he compiled a whole collection of phony allegations that showed Donald Trump to have the basest of character and the most damaging suggestion of collusion with the Russians that were intended to incriminate Donald Trump, the candidate, in the most sordid situations. And it was all made up. All fabricated. Steele himself said that he could not swear that any of what appeared in the dossier that he had written was true. It later turned out that Steele was paid for this work of fiction by the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. And yet, even though this was phony, it formed the basis of secret wiretaps, secret informants, and a $35 million special counsel investigation that came to be known as the Mueller investigation. In the end, it didn't find anything to accuse the president of. Not collusion, not obstruction of justice, nothing. And yet here we are again with a new accusation, a new complaint that is forming the basis for impeachment proceedings against the president. And this is interesting because this complaint was written by an anonymous person who did not have firsthand information and yet filed this very detailed legal complaint, which looks more like it was written by attorneys than that it was written by a lowly whistleblower. And the president is once again standing with his back against the wall, being harassed mercilessly by Democrats, led by Adam Schiff, the head of the Congressional Intelligence Committee, whose only agenda is to bring down the duly elected sitting president of the United States. And why is he doing this? Because he, like all the other Democrats who are following in his lead, never accepted the fact that Donald Trump won the 2016 election for President of the United States, and their candidate, Hillary Clinton, lost. You know, we have a tradition in this country, and that is that no matter how hard, how bitterly we fight each other every 4 years for the presidential nomination and then election, no matter how hard we fight, when the election is over, we fold up our tents and we go home until the next election. And we all go back to just being Americans, all of us, together. But that's not happening anymore. And we are now at a crisis point. This is like deja vu. We've seen this movie before. The president is facing another witch hunt which has strikingly familiar tones as it mirrors the witch hunt that was carried on as a result of the Democrats' use of the Steele dossier to attack the president and his supporters. The anonymous complaint is a repetition of the Steele dossier based on hearsay and, who knows, made up information without any credible first-person knowledge of the actual conversation. If you have read the transcript of the telephone conversation which Donald Trump had with the president of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky, there's not much there to complain against the president about. One might find fault with the fact that he did raise the question of an investigation into the possibly illegal activities of Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden. But it seems to me that when two heads of state have what is supposed to be a private and classified conversation about the issues that are troubling them both, then it seems to me that it is perfectly okay for them to discuss possible solutions to those problems, even when those issues are sensitive. Now, in this case, the situation is complicated by the fact that Joe Biden not only was vice president at the time when these actions were taken, and what he did was to use his influence as vice president of the United States and a threat of withholding $1 billion in loan credits in order to protect his son Hunter from prosecution in Ukraine. This is something that needs to be looked into. The problem arises, of course, that Joe Biden is running for president against President Trump, and that might lead you to the conclusion that this was an inappropriate request. But this wasn't a secret. Joe Biden actually bragged about it in a presentation he was making for the Council on Foreign Relations. And he talked about how he withheld the money. He said, "You're not getting this unless you fire the prosecutor." Well, here's a question. I'm puzzled because I don't understand why the fact that a person is running for public office makes him immune to accountability for illegal acts which he did before he started running. And that's a question I still have yet to be answered by anybody who would take the position that this is the wrong thing to do. Now, one of the arguments that's being made on behalf of Biden is that the prosecutor himself was corrupt and that firing him did a service to everybody. But I'd like to read to you something that appeared in the press this weekend. It was written by the former Ukrainian prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, the man that Biden got fired, and this is his story. This is what he said. Quote, "The truth is, I was forced out because I was leading a wide-ranging corruption probe into Burisma Holdings, a natural gas firm active in Ukraine." And by the way, that was the company that Joe Biden's son, Hunter, had been hired to sit on the board at an enormous salary, $50,000 a month, although he had very little in the way of credentials, but he did have access. Shokin continued, quote, "President Poroshenko asked me to have a look at the criminal case against Burisma and consider the possibility of winding down the investigation against this company. But I refused to close the investigation," unquote. And that is why he was fired, in order to protect Joe Biden's son, Hunter, from prosecution in Ukraine. Okay, let's get back to the story. So now we have a situation where the President of the United States is not only once again under attack, but he is now facing an impeachment investigation. And that's a serious thing. It's happened before. It happened to Bill Clinton. But this is different because the president is being accused from all sides not only for high crimes and misdemeanors, but also he has been accused of treason. I don't get it. I think this is so wrong on so many levels. And one of the things that I think is so wrong is that the president is not being given his constitutional rights. For example, according to the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, the president, like any other American citizen, has a right to be confronted with the witnesses against him, in this case, the whistleblower. So why is the president not being allowed to face his accuser? Every American has that right guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. Nobody knows who the whistleblower is, and the president has not had the opportunity to face his accuser. This is unconstitutional and probably illegal and certainly unfair, every way you look at it. Adam Schiff, who is the chair of the Congressional Intelligence Committee that will be hearing this impeachment inquiry, has become the public face of the impeachment campaign. And he is the one who is leading the charge. Now he, it seems, has no problem with depriving the president of his constitutional right to face his accuser. He, in fact, is leaning over backwards to help the whistleblower maintain his secrecy. In fact, Adam Schiff has said that when the whistleblower comes to testify to his committee, his identity will be protected. This sounds like a setup if I ever heard one. The level of hatred that Democrats feel for the president is so deep and so toxic, it has become something that could be considered pathological. The president is always wrong, no matter what he does. He is wrong because he is sitting in the White House instead of Hillary Clinton. The Democrats will never get over that, and they will never forgive him. In fact, the dysfunction, what we call the Trump delusion syndrome, has become so serious that it no longer is a joke. It no longer can be taken lightly because the country is being damaged so badly that we may be reaching a point of no return. Here's an example of what I'm talking about. Just the other day, Nancy Pelosi was asked if she was worried about losing the Congress to the Republicans in 2020. And she said, "It doesn't matter. Our first responsibility is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States," unquote. Is she kidding? Protect and defend the Constitution? She talks about the president of the United States undermining his oath of office, his loyalty to his oath of office, undermining our national security and undermining the integrity of our elections. She said, "Our elections are the fundamental point of our democracy," unquote. But it's the Democrats who refused to accept the results of our election, which she calls fundamental to our democracy. It is the Democrats who are dividing this country with their hatred of the man who won the election because he didn't lose the election. But who is undermining our national security and who is undermining the integrity of our elections? It's the Democrats who refuse to accept the legitimacy of Donald Trump's presidency. And they have done since then everything in their power to undermine the president and to attack the president on every level that they possibly can in order to drive him from the Oval Office, even before 2020. And that's what this impeachment process is all about. And then can't even do that right, because in order to carry out an impeachment, you have to have a vote, and then you have to open up a regular impeachment process. They haven't done that. They're just going to talk, and they're going to harass, and they're going to make Donald Trump's life as miserable as possible. They're going to interfere with his doing his job, even as they refuse to do their own. They are not doing their jobs. They are not upholding their constitutional obligation. They're in Congress to legislate, but they're not doing that. They are spending their time and their resources on whatever will interfere with the president's purpose, his agenda. They are undermining the very basis of their constitutional authority. The Democrats are not willing to get anything done in Congress because anything the president wanted, they refused to do, and they were so busy going after the president that they didn't get anything done for their own constituents. It's a very sad story. But it is the story of our time, and it's something that we really have to understand because it is destroying our national ethic. They're not legislating. They are marshaling all their efforts to attack the president and bring him down. And that's why I am so angry. That is why I am so outraged at their behavior and at their accusations against the president and all that he stands for and the things that have made America so great over the last 2.5 centuries. What is amazing to me is that this president seems to be capable of withstanding whatever they throw at him. And I only pray that he continues to have this fortitude, this ability to be rock solid in the face of their hysteria and their dysfunction. God bless America. And God bless President Trump. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then I'll be right back with another story about Abraham Lincoln, the most hated president in our history.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
President Trump is under attack. Nothing new there. He has been since before he was elected. And after his election, the attacks began ramping up and they got worse and worse. And they came from the Democrats, who refused to accept the fact that Hillary Clinton lost the election and Donald Trump won. Now, this is a situation that has gotten worse since Trump's inauguration and continues to get worse as the Democrats now are engaging in what they call an impeachment investigation. They refuse to say what his crime was because they really don't know. And they're casting around to see if there's something that he did that they can label as illegal, as treasonous, as something that they can get him for in order to get him out of the White House. And that's their goal. So what's happening while they're doing this? Bills are languishing in the House while Congress pursues an impeachment investigation. It's apparently so important that everything else in Congress has come to a screeching halt. I've heard it said, and it's repeated over and over again, that Donald Trump is the most unpopular president in the history of this country. People who say that don't know the history of this country. The amazing thing is that he is not the most unpopular. If it's a tie, he stands in good company. And the amazing thing is, the other most unpopular president in this country, who was so reviled that he was denounced and denigrated by the press and by fellow politicians, even before he ever got to the White House. Sound familiar? But get this. He was a man we now consider to be one of the greatest presidents in our history. That man was Abraham Lincoln. Did you know that? Did you know how much people hated him? And how do we know this? Well, there's a lot of documentation about this, and I'd like to introduce you to some of it. Listen to this. Even as Abraham Lincoln was riding on the train to Washington for his 1861 presidential inauguration, the Salem Advocate, which was a newspaper from Lincoln's home state of Illinois, had a lot to say about Abraham Lincoln. And this is what they wrote. Quote, "The illustrious, honest old Abe has continued during the last week to make a fool of himself and to mortify and shame the intelligent people of this great nation. His speeches have demonstrated the fact that although originally a Herculean rail splitter and more lately a whimsical storyteller and side splitter, he is no more capable of becoming a statesman, even a moderate one, than the braying ass can become a noble lion. People now marvel how it came to pass that Mr. Lincoln should have been selected as the representative man of any party. His weak, wishy-washy, namby-pamby efforts, imbecile in matter, disgusting in manner, have made us the laughingstock of the whole world. The European powers will despise us because we have no better material out of which to make a president." Unquote. Well, that's pretty harsh stuff. And they were far from alone. Samuel Bowes, the editor of the Massachusetts newspaper, the Springfield Republican, wrote a letter to a friend of his that same week, and he said simply, quote, "Lincoln is a simple Susan." Unquote. One of the greatest orators of the time, Edward Everett, wrote in his diary about Lincoln, quote, "He is evidently a person of very inferior cast of character, wholly unequal to the crisis," unquote. And Congressman Charles Francis Adams wrote, quote, "His speeches," referring to Lincoln, "have fallen like a wet blanket here. They put to flight all notions of greatness," unquote. The contempt of the nation for him was so universal, so vicious, so personal, that it is difficult to see how in the world he was ever elected in the first place. Until now, it marked an historic low in the history of the United States for the prestige of the office and the person who was President of the United States. By the time he was actually sworn in, his approval rating, such as it was, they didn't do polls then, but it could be estimated by Republican losses in local elections in New York, Ohio, Missouri, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, and by the actual vote count. The New York Herald wrote that maybe only 1 million of the 4.7 million voters in the United States who voted in that election were still with him. And this was less than 3 months after the election. They put his actual support at about 25%. And he hadn't even become president yet. So how could he be elected in November if he were so hated by February? It actually wasn't anything he himself did or didn't do, but almost nobody knew him. We didn't have the internet then. We didn't have Twitter and Facebook. He was almost an unknown to Americans. The South was hostile to him because he represented what they considered to be a threat to the country. And here, if you just look at his history, he had never been an administrator of anything. He had just had a two-person law office, and it was only the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862 that turned him from the rail splitter, the country yokel, and made him the ultimate statesman, the great emancipator. But that wasn't the view at the time. That's our view now. In 1862, the Chicago Times called the Emancipation Proclamation, quote, a monstrous usurpation, a criminal wrong, and an act of national suicide, unquote. An editorial in an Ohio newspaper, The Crisis, asked, quote, is this not a death blow to the hope of the Union, unquote. And they went further. They said, quote, we have no doubt that this proclamation seals the fate of this Union as it was and the Constitution as it is. The time is brief when we shall have a dictator proclaimed, all caps, for the proclamation can never be carried out except under the iron rule of the worst kind of despotism, unquote. His own secretary, William Stoddard, who was in charge of reading Lincoln's mail, wrote, dictator is what the opposition press and orators of all sizes are calling him. There is no telling how many editors and how many other penmen within these past few days have undertaken to assure him that this is a war for the Union only, and that they never gave him any authority to run it as an abolition war, unquote. Well, we all know that these opinions ended up on the wrong side of history, but there was an even larger crisis brewing that had Americans worried, really worried. There were enough angry letters from soldiers to their families to give credence to the rumors that a military revolt was possible and even imminent. A New York Herald correspondent wrote this. The army is dissatisfied and the air is thick with revolution. God knows what will be the consequence. And at present, matters look dark indeed, and there is a large promise of a fearful revolution, which will sweep before it not only the administration, but popular government, unquote. And in the midterm election of 1862, the states that had elected him into the presidency in 1860, 2 years earlier, had deserted him. All of them sent new Democrat majorities to Congress. In fact, Democrats in the House almost doubled, and they cut the Republican majority to just 55%. So when the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect on January 1st, 1863, Lincoln was being attacked on a daily basis. Lincoln was isolated and alone. The South was now much closer to secession because the South had feared at the time of Lincoln's election that he would abolish slavery and that the Emancipation Proclamation would kindle that flame of secession. Now the fear was real because the law was in effect. The popular revolt came in July 1863. Two things had happened. The Emancipation Proclamation, which we know about, and the draft law, which was passed shortly afterwards. Riots broke out in New York, and the Civil War began. And then a surprising thing happened. Somehow, Lincoln was renominated at the party convention in early June 1864. But when we talk about hatred of the president, it was still there. It hadn't gone anywhere. But political expedience had made the renomination of Lincoln a reality. For example, James Gordon Bennett, who was a columnist in the New York Herald, wrote, quote, the politicians have again chosen this presidential pygmy as their nominee, unquote. And then over the summer, things got worse. Washington was nearly captured in July 1864 by a rebel detachment, and the Democrat newspaper, the New York World, printed an editorial from the Richmond Examiner that said, quote, the fact begins to shine out clear that Abraham Lincoln is lost, that he will never be president again. The obscene ape of Illinois, that's what they called him, is about to be deposed from the Washington Purple, and the White House will echo to his little jokes no more. Unquote. But then, in August, the Democrats nominated George McClellan on a platform that said, "The war is a failure. Peace now." Sound familiar? And what happened next was that for many Republicans, there is no way that Lincoln could ever be as bad as McClellan would be. And then something else happened before the election in September. The Union's Major General T. Sherman in Georgia sent a telegram that said, quote, "Atlanta is ours and fairly won," unquote. And with that telegram, public opinion flipped. A friend of Lincoln's wrote, "There was no time between January of 1864 and September 3rd of the same year when McClellan would not have defeated Lincoln for president," unquote. But then on September 4th, the day after that telegram was sent, the tide almost miraculously turned itself around. The fall of Atlanta was the first of many victories of the Union Army. And by the time November came around, the president had won 212 electoral votes to only 21 for McClellan. The popular vote wasn't so exciting, not for the president. He had won 54% in 1860, and it went up 1% to 55% in 1864, when the war was almost over. A shift of less than 1% of the popular vote would have elected McClellan. But because of our Electoral College, which was mandated by our Constitution, but for that, Lincoln would have lost the election. And yet, history has declared that Lincoln was one of our greatest presidents. The hatred of Lincoln during his presidency is not unlike the hatred that we see today toward President Donald Trump. If anything, it was worse. And yet, today, Lincoln is considered one of our greatest presidents. It's really quite a remarkable story. And one of the things that I take away from this is the similarities between the public and almost universal hatred of this president to what is happening now to Donald Trump. But there is a difference here, and maybe we can draw some conclusions to what is happening to the very living President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. If you look at the polls, you see that his numbers aren't extraordinary. The good news is that the latest polls show that he has a favorability rating of some 53%. It's the highest he's had. And it's a good sign as we approach the 2020 elections. However, I don't think it tells the whole story. Abraham Lincoln didn't have the benefit of polls. And he certainly did not have the support of nearly half the voters in the United States, Republican and Democrat. But Donald Trump has something. He has what I call a popularity factor that does not show up on the polls. When Donald Trump has a rally, 100,000 people reply to RSVPs because they want to attend. And of course, the venues that he has his rallies in don't hold 100,000 people. Maybe they hold 10 or 15,000. Yet people line up 48 hours before the event, and sometimes they stand there in the rain waiting to get into the rally so they can be there in person to see their president, Donald J. Trump. These rallies are amazing, and I think they tell a story that the polls do not reflect. There is, in my opinion, a very serious, silent majority. The people who show up, they're not silent at the rallies. But when the polls are taken, they don't respond. And I believe that no matter who is running against Donald J. Trump in the elections, I believe these people will come out to vote in massive numbers. And that the result of this election will not be nearly as ambiguous as it was last time around in 2016. Isn't it interesting that a president who was more reviled than Donald Trump was a man that we consider to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest president in the history of this country. And in spite of the fact that the hatred that the Democrats bear for our president today is so ugly and has so totally infected their vision, that the work they were sent to Washington to do has not been getting done. There is no legislative process going on right now. Everything is pointed toward destroying the presidency of Donald J. Trump. And the interesting thing is they haven't done that. Donald Trump has been one of the most effective and constructive presidents that we have had in many years. It is helpful to remember that although the hatred of the Democrats and of the left is so destructive in so many ways, this president continues to be strong enough to stand up to it, to still come out to the public relaxed and open and transparent. And so, as we approach the 2020 elections, we are looking at something quite remarkable that is happening on our political landscape. And we will have to see how the president continues to hold up even in the face of the threat of an impeachment hearing. Okay, well, we are going to take another break, a short one. And when I come back, we're going to go to that segment that I call, You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up. And I'll tell you some stories to make you laugh or cry, depending on how you feel about things.
The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good-taste in gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut, not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company Healthy Cell will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com.
So here we are back again, and I want to tell you a couple of stories that made me laugh. In New York City, there is a patch of green called Central Park. And in Central Park, there are walking paths, and you can drive through the park, and there is a kind of amphitheater, and there's a zoo. It's called the Central Park Zoo. And there's a carousel. At least these are the things that I remember when I was growing up in a city outside of New York, and my parents would take me to Central Park, and we went to all these places. Well, it's more than a patch of green. It's actually 843 acres, and there are a total of 29 sculptures in Central Park. They're really very beautiful, and yet there's a movement now to take these sculptures down. It makes me crazy to think that people want to do this, and it makes me even crazier because I know why they want to do it. So here's the deal. There's now a movement to take down the statues of the men and replace them with statues of women. Really? And this movement is being spearheaded by the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, who lately ran for president and then dropped out. And he thinks it's a great idea. In fact, he thinks it's such a good idea that he has set up a commission to decide which statues to remove, which is to say, which statues of men to remove, and which women should be memorialized in sculptures that would replace the men. So who are the men who are so objectionable that their statues cannot continue to grace the green fields of Central Park? Who are they? What terrible persons? Genghis Khan? Ivan the Terrible? Who are they? De Blasio has made it pretty clear. He wants to replace the statues of Christopher Columbus. He didn't do much except discover America, as we were taught when we were little kids. And poet Robert Burns, better known to friends and family as Bobby Burns. Robert Burns wrote many poems, but one of them is the poem Auld Lang Syne. You know the song we sing every New Year's Eve? Should auld acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Well, that's the one. Anyway, he wrote that, and he has a statue memorializing him in Central Park as well. So the commission wants to remove that too. And how about the statue of Alexander Hamilton, Daniel Webster, the great orator? And how about William Shakespeare? He was no slouch. He gave us a lot of good plays and some really good poems. And what about Hans Christian Andersen, who wrote all those wonderful children's fairy tales? He's there too. But still, political correctness needs to have its day in court. As I said, de Blasio really likes this idea of replacing the men's statues with the women's statues. And he liked it so well that he set up a commission to make a decision about which men should come down and which women should go up. And the commission agreed with de Blasio that this was really a very good idea. One of the members of de Blasio's commission, a very well-educated man and clearly a scholar, made the following comment. He said, quote, "There are, what, 4, 5, or 6 male statues that I think could easily be replaced by individual statues of each of these women," unquote. And he had a list of women that he was proposing. He said, "I don't think there are many people who will miss the Burns statue." Clearly a man of great culture. But the problem with all these people who were memorialized in statues in Central Park, the problem with them is they're all guys. And we can't have that. They're just statues of old dead guys. They're dispensable. And we can replace them with statues of dead women. Why not? But hey, I have an idea. What about this? How big did I say this park was? 843 acres? Surely there's room somewhere in this park for a few more statues. Statues of women. How about let's leave the men alone and put up some new statues? You want women up there? I agree with that. There are lots of women that we could memorialize with sculptures. So I have a list. I have a list of women whose statues would certainly add meaning to the beauty of Central Park. How about Rosa Parks, who, because she was just dog-tired one day, sat in the front of the bus because she just couldn't bear to walk to the back, and she inspired the movement that ultimately integrated the public buses in Montgomery, Alabama, and then the buses throughout the entire South. And that led to restaurants and department stores and all manner of public accommodation. It was one small step in the civil rights movement, but it made all the difference. And then how about Amelia Earhart, who was one of the first women to fly and who lost her life doing what she loved best? Or how about Sojourner Truth or Harriet Tubman? They were great women and they did their part in changing the world. Or how about Eleanor Roosevelt? My goodness, her husband Franklin Roosevelt became president, and when he did, she became an activist promoting human rights, women's rights, children's causes, and she became chair of the United Nations Human Rights Commission in 1945. Well, how about Anne Frank? A young Jewish girl who died in a Nazi concentration camp in 1945, but was memorialized in her diary, which her father saved and later published. Her writing helped historians to better understand what it was like to live under the Nazis. How about Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer? She made history by becoming the first African-American woman to win a Grammy. How about Shirley Chisholm? She was the first black woman to be elected to Congress, and she even ran for president. Or Betty Friedan, activist for women's rights. How about Sandra Day O'Connor, who became the first woman to be appointed to the United States Supreme Court? How silly it is to even think that there is value in tearing down the statues of men and replacing them with statues of women. It's hard to believe people really do things like that, that they really think things like that. You just can't make this stuff up. And here's another story. You know, it wasn't that long ago. Well, I guess it was. It was years ago. I ran for Congress. I ran twice, in fact. I lost both times. But I gave it a good effort. And I remember one day I was campaigning at a local county fair, and a guy came over to me, and he was really interested in what I had to say and what my platform was. And he hung around for quite a while, and we talked and talked. And finally he looked at me and he said, "Ilana, why in the world would you want to go down and be in that cesspool?" And I had to laugh, because now when we talk about cleaning up the swamp, that's what he was talking about. I had a lot to learn back then, but I thought that was something that always stuck with me. I appreciated the comment at the time, and I appreciate it a lot more now. One day, I was at another fair, and I was sitting at the booth for my campaign, and I had with me a dog, my dog. His name was Molson, and he was a fluffy, long-haired combination of Labrador Retriever and Golden Retriever, and he was beautiful. He was sort of yellow and white, and very, very sweet and very, very friendly. People came over and they said hello, and they petted the dog, and it was very nice and very friendly, because I was trying to introduce myself to people, and I was very eager to meet them. But one woman who had a young child with her was walking nearby, and the child came running over to pet the dog. And of course, the dog would have given her a big kiss, and she would have been able to hug the dog, because that's the kind of dog he was. But the mother ran after the child. She says, "No, no, 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 they're Republicans. He'll probably bite you." Well, enough said. It was actually a pretty cool campaign. I had a very old, it was like a camper truck, and we had it outfitted, and it had big signs all over it that said, "Ilana," and then underneath it said, "She's not one of the boys," and that was part of my campaign slogan, not the whole thing. But anyway, that was a good experience. I never did get down to the cesspool, and that was probably a good thing for all around. And now, in the time we have left, I'd like to just bring you up to date on a few news items. Hong Kong is still in turmoil. China has still not gone in to impose its military might on the people of Hong Kong. It seems as though the Chinese realize that they have a lot to lose if they were to pull another Tiananmen Square in Hong Kong. And so they are showing enormous restraint, which is a good thing, surprising, but a good thing. And China also has to worry about the effect that such a military move would have on the trade talks, which at the moment, the sanctions are hurting China very badly. So there's a lot for China to consider, and they are doing the wise thing. But in the meantime, the demonstrations in Hong Kong are getting increasingly violent, and that's a bad thing. Iran is making some very serious noises about its neighbors. And one of the things that Iran has done within the last few days has been to tell the world that it no longer has to wait to attack and destroy Israel, that it now has the capability to do that. Now, I don't know if you remember, but I have talked about this before. I began writing about it in January 2014, that when the United Nations nuclear inspectors began showing up on Iran's front doorstep, Iran organized a major airlift to North Korea. And on that airlift, they basically put all of their nuclear R&D and sent it over to North Korea, where they collaborated with the North Koreans on nuclear development. They had several projects: to build a plutonium bomb, to miniaturize it so that it would fit on top of a Shahab missile, and to also develop the delivery systems that could go further than what they now were capable of. And in the course of the years that followed, between 2012 and 2018, the nuclear development went well, and over time, they tested 5 nuclear bombs. They built a test chamber inside a mountain, Mount Muntap, and they tested the 5 nuclear bombs inside that mountain. And then they had to stop because the mountain began to show signs of collapsing. And now it seems as though they are working on developing other test sites. And Iran is still working in North Korea, according to my sources. However, one of the things we hear very often about Iran is that we must keep them from getting nuclear weapons. The problem is that it is my understanding from the people with whom I work in the intelligence field that they already have a nuclear bomb, and so does North Korea. And Japan has made some statements that confirms that. So we're dealing with a situation where Iran already has a nuclear bomb, and the statement that they made this past week, in which they said they no longer have to worry about being able to destroy Israel, they now have the capability to do it. That's very worrisome, very worrisome. American intelligence is taking notice, as undoubtedly Israeli and Saudi Arabian and all the other intelligence agencies in the Middle East are also taking note. What we have to look at now is what kind of reaction time we would have if Iran decided to use a nuclear device on any other country. And that is a very great worry. We will have to see. So we've talked about the Israeli elections, and that is still up in the air. They can't come together. The current Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is trying very hard to put together a coalition, but at the same time, he's under a lot of pressure because he is facing a hearing on corruption charges. And that has got to be putting a lot of pressure on him as well. He desperately wants to be prime minister. But if he doesn't put a coalition together, he's not going to be able to do that. So we'll have to wait and see what happens in Israel. It is still a waiting game. So in China, where we still have to worry about working out a trade deal, it's a waiting game. In Iran, where we are waiting for the next threat, it's a waiting game. And in Israel, where they still don't have a new government, it's a waiting game. In the meantime, here in the United States, Adam Schiff is moving forward with an impeachment inquiry, and we'll have to see how that turns out as well. So it's been a crazy week. We're living in a crazy world, but it never stops being interesting. I want to thank you for spending this hour with me, and I hope to see you again next week. As always, I love to hear from you. If you have any comments, any questions, if you agree with me, or if you don't agree with me, I'd love to hear from you. Let me know. Write to me at Ilana@AmericaOutloud.com. I'll get your emails and I will answer them. You've been listening to News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Ilana Friedman, and this has been The Friedman Report.